Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website, that's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on organic living, organic foods, when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. He was the former editor of the New York Tribune. Here's what he said to the New York Press Association back in 1936, on February 26, 1936. He said, quote, "There's no such thing as a free and independent press in America, unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you that dares express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. Now, if I should permit my honest opinions to be printed in just one issue of my paper, like Othello, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Our business," he said, "is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are the tools of rich men behind the scenes. We are intellectual prostitutes." Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this global 2000 New World Order program. Men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, Vanderbilts. I say it's time to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and this global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy and the New World Order, why don't you call and order my 4-hour compact disc package? It's free. Remember, it's educational, entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you could go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. You know, I get asked quite often about this thing of organic. What is it, anyway? What is organic? You know, the average guy on the street buys his groceries out of the grocery store, out of the supermarket, and he's pretty satisfied. It's USDA approved, and it's clean, and the supermarket is clean and neat, and the shelves are well stocked. You know, just go into Walmart, and you'll like it in there, don't you? I do. I go into Walmart, and I like the place. They got a guy there that greets me at the door. That makes me feel special. Makes me feel good. They've got a good sales program at Walmart. And they've got everything that you want. And you don't have to stop in 5 different stores and take all day. You can just walk into Walmart and get it all. And they didn't do that accidentally. They're doing that on purpose. It's a competitive advantage that they have with size. They've also got a competitive advantage that they have in price. The local shoe store, you know, the mom and pop shoe store, cannot compete with Walmart. And that's why when you put a Walmart into a small rural area, the small businesses go out of business. Walmart drives them out. They don't take a gun, walk into the store like the mafia used to, and throw them out. They just price them out, and they're gone. But Walmart doesn't sell organic. And so the guy that is selling organic has a competitive edge for those of us that want to buy organic, because I don't buy inorganic. Well, I shouldn't say I don't buy any. I buy some. When I can't find organic, I might buy a chemically grown tomato, but if I can find organic fresh tomatoes, which is what we can do right now, you know, from all summer long into the fall, we'll have fresh tomatoes and they come out of our garden. And if they don't come out of our garden, they come out of a neighbor's garden, or I'll buy them on the street or someplace. I buy organic because it's better for my health. That's why I buy organic. It's better for my health. Now, there's other people that buy organic because it's better for the environment. Yeah, there's some truth to that, too, that it's better to buy organic rather than to buy inorganic, because everything that's grown with chemicals, those chemicals leach out of the soil and ultimately end up going down your rivers and streams. Now, we humans have been practicing organic farming since the Great Flood, and probably before the Flood they were practicing organic farming, but we haven't got any history of it, so I can't say. But since that time, all the history books tell us and show us that we've been practicing organic farming for about 5,000 years on this planet, and it served us well. It served us well. And there's been a lot of innovations and a lot of new technology and techniques. You know, we have bigger, sweeter, better cherries, plums, tomatoes, and greater varieties of fruits and vegetables in our modern world today than our forefathers ever dreamed of having. I eat better than King Solomon ever ate. He was the richest man in the world and had 700 wives. And Solomon never ate as well as George Gordon. Probably didn't eat as well as you do. Yes, sir. Solomon probably ate well for his time, but he never had the opportunity to have strawberries in January. I'll just bet you he didn't have kiwis from Australia or New Zealand and bananas from Nicaragua, and then put a fruit salad together with bananas from Central America, strawberries and plums and peaches and all kinds of fruits that are flowing in on 747s from around the world, and enjoy that in January. Yes, sir? You and I can do that in modern America, and probably in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. They couldn't do that 100 years ago. It's only been in the last 25 to 50 years that we've had this kind of technology, a technological revolution. And most people give the credit for this food technology and revolution to chemicals. Now, I don't think chemicals deserve all the credit. In fact, I think the chemicals deserve none of the credit. Technology deserves some of the credit. The chemicals are actually destroying the infrastructure of agriculture. And I'm going to show you that in this series of programs. That, yes, organic's good for you and it's better for you nutritionally, but it's also good for the planet and good for the environment. And it's good for a number of other reasons. 5,000 years of history can't be eradicated with 100 years of technology. And that's about how long we've been experimenting with chemicals and hybridization, is just about 100 years. And these chemicals now have gotten to a place where if you take a look at the agricultural productive gains, they're actually going down now. And that's because the thing that makes soil productive is the organic material in the soil. You can grow things hydroponically, and that's what American soil has become. It's become the hydroponic base where it holds the roots and it supports the plant, but we feed the chemicals, we feed the nutrients to the plant. And here's the surprising part. The plant can get no more out of the soil than we put in. It's kind of like baby formula. You go into the store and you come out and you have this Similac and you say, wow, look at this. It's got new vitamins and minerals put in here. Natural mother's milk has 92 minerals in it. Well, that's assuming, of course, that mother has the 92 minerals in her body. If she doesn't have those minerals in her body, it's not in her breast milk either. But if she's eating well and she's got all of the 92 minerals, all the vitamins and minerals and enzymes that go into it, her breast milk will have it and that newborn baby will have it. And that newborn baby won't have colic, won't get sick, and won't have to go to the pediatrician. I know that's a tragedy. You won't have anything to talk about at the Bridge Club about how you took your baby to the pediatrician and how you're having all this problem with colic. I think people like sick babies so that they can talk about them. That was always my opinion. Whenever the women, when I was a little kid, whenever women would get together and talk, they always talked about their children. They always talked about their children's aches and pains and all their sicknesses. Now, my granny was a pretty good old granny. I was raised by my grandmother after she'd raised seven children and had learned how to do it. By the time I came along, she wasn't experimenting anymore. She knew what she was doing. And I didn't get sick. She didn't give me shots and vaccinations. And she didn't let me stick my feet into the Buster Brown machine to get x-rays. She was a suspicious old gal. She thought, if God didn't make it, it wasn't fit to use. That was her thing in life. If God didn't make it, it probably wasn't fit to use. And God didn't give us x-rays. And if he'd have wanted us to do x-rays, he'd have given us x-ray vision like Superman. And he didn't. And she was suspicious of it. She was suspicious of vaccinations. You know, if God had intended for us to be vaccinated, we'd have been born with a needle sticking out of our arm. And so I got away without these vaccinations, but I noticed that when she would be talking to other women, they would always bring up the subject of all the sicknesses and ailments of their children, and I didn't have these sicknesses and ailments. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't have any. I had a few. And of course, when I had a few, they'd bring them up. But the point I'm making is I didn't have very many, so there wasn't much to talk about little Georgie. I'm 65. I'm in good health. I can work most men 30 years old under the table today. And I'm old, and I can only work half what I could when I was a kid. But I've been eating right. You know, I eat pretty well. And I try to take care of myself, and I eat organic. And the reason that I eat organic and drink raw milk and eat fish and I eat meat that hasn't come off the feedlots is because I know what goes into the eggs that you buy in the store. I wouldn't eat those eggs out of the store. I know what goes into those cattle in the feedlots, and that's why I won't eat beef. Well, I won't eat beef that comes out of a restaurant or out of a supermarket. I eat my own. Now, I raise sheep. I raise chickens. You know, and I've got a few cows, and I drink my own milk. And we have a garden, and we eat organic. And I don't do that accidentally. I do it on purpose. And when I talk about that over the air, people write in, and they want to know, well, tell us the story. Tell us about organic living. Tell us about land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Well, let me start off with land Sabbaths and Jubilees. In Leviticus chapter 23, you'll find a full chapter in there about land Sabbaths and Jubilees. It has to do with two key laws in Scripture. One is the monetary system, and the other is soil fertility. And the way soil fertility works is this. Out here on the Great Plains, the buffalo would eat the grass. The grass goes through the buffalo, and it comes out in the form of manure. Now, most of you have never had an opportunity to explore a cow pie, a pile of manure. But I have. I've been in the business for many years, and I've had an opportunity to observe it. And these are called ruminant animals. And what they do is they chew this grass off, and then they regurgitate it, and they chew it up very fine. And when you look at this cow pie, this cow pile, this cow manure, it's got just millions of little pieces of grass, just very finely chewed up. And what that is dirt. It's organic material. And it composts naturally. It breaks down with bacteria action. And the black that you see in the soil, that's what that is. That's what that is. It's the dead humus plant material of either dead, dying grasses, brushes, trees. Now, when you get trees and brush, you have to have ants, carpenter ants, and termites to chew it up and break it down. And then the bacteria get after it, and they break it down. And this process produces 186,000 little creatures that live in a cubic foot of soil. So if you took a cubic foot of soil, 12 by 12 by 12, 1,728 cubic inches, you'd have 186,000 little living creatures in there, and some of them will be spiders and ants and termites. Some of them will be nematodes and bacteria and all kinds of, well, I wouldn't say bacteria because there's probably billions of those, but the little creatures that you can see, you know, ticks and bugs, and they're all just, it's a little miniature world of living matter and material. And all of those insects and all of those little creatures working on that soil is what creates soil fertility. So God, the designer of this process, he said, now once every 7 years, you gotta let this process run its course. Now you can mine this, you can take out of it 6 years in a row, but once every 7 years, to maintain this balance, you gotta let it rest. Very simple process, no big deal. Let's say that you've been growing corn on this ground for the last 6 years. It's not a good practice to practice monoculture that way, but let's suppose you have, and the soil's strong enough to withstand this corn onslaught and this nitrogen deprivation for 6 years. You let it rest a year. You let whatever's natural or whatever's in the soil, weeds and etc., grow up. And you come in, you cut it off, chop it up, disc it in, and that organic material, that natural organic material in the soil, will be enough fertilizer to fertilize that ground and to feed all of those creatures, which in turn are breaking the inorganic particles down and converting those to organic. Let me tell you how that process works. You can go out here in my woods and you'll see rock. And it's really poor soil out here in the woods. It's rock, clay, shelf rock. I mean, it's really pretty bad stuff. And there are some places where oak trees won't grow. And where oak trees won't grow, right off of solid rock, the moss and lichens do. Well, the moss and lichens will send out carbolic acid and melt the rock down and convert it into organic material. And that's the bottom of the food chain, moss and lichen. And then up the food chain, you'll find other smaller, sporadic plants. And these usually grow in the woods, in the shade, on rocks. And then as you go up the food chain, you'll find brush, weeds, and other plants. And then pretty soon, you'll get a cedar tree, which can grow right out of the rocks. There's a crack in the rock. Here comes a cedar tree. Now what's going on here is the moss and the lichen can live just about on 100% inorganic material. If they've got water, plenty of moisture, they will grow right out of the rocks. And the carbolic acid will convert the rock into organic material, and then that dead organic material combined with the rock is enough to keep that lichen and moss working. Now, out here in the woods then, as you go up the food chain, you'll find that cedar trees can convert. They're slow growing, and they can convert about, 75 to 90% of their wood mass right out of solid rock, inorganic material. But all plants need organic material. If they don't have organic material, they'll die. So plants grow on both organic and inorganic. And the way that works is that the tree puts out carbolic acid. The carbolic acid melts and breaks down the rock and converts it into wood fiber and takes it up into the tree. The tree dies, falls on the ground. The termites and wood ants and other bacteria and fungus and fungi, they get in there and they break that down. And that organic material, that is the wood in the tree, rots and it becomes organic material for the next generation to eat. Now, as you go up the food chain, pretty soon you get to grasses and you get up to carrots and rutabagas. Now remember, the lichen and moss can live just about on 100%, not quite, but almost 100% inorganic material. By the time you get up to carrots, they got to have 90%, 75, 80, 90% organic material. And then they can convert the 10% inorganic into the minerals that they need to make a complete plant. A plant that has in it all of the vitamins and minerals and nutrients that you need to maintain healthy life. Now that's the way God designed the program. And in order to maintain that soil fertility, he said, now take a look out here on the Great Plains. When our forefathers got out here on the Central Plains and Great Plains, Plowman's Folly, Lee Falconer reported that in 1830 to 1850, when they got out to Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, that a man could be sitting on a horse and hidden in the grass. It was that tall. It was 12 feet tall, hiding a man on a horse. Now, the moldboard plow, John Deere, that invented the moldboard plow, did that to break up the sod, to kill that life in the upper surface of the soil, turn it over so the sun would bake those roots out so that they could plant carrots and rutabagas, because they couldn't plant it where there was 12 feet tall grass. The grass would shade it out. So the moldboard plow was designed to destroy life, organic life in the soil. And it does, and it did, and it worked like a shot. Now, that ought to tell you that, well, we don't need it anymore, do we? And in most farming operations, we don't use plows, we just use big gang discs. But in the old days, they used to turn that soil over to kill that sod. Now, that sod itself was organic material. So, our forefathers didn't practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, and indeed they didn't need to. Because there was so much organic material in the soil that when you took off a ton of potatoes, when you take off 2,000 pounds of potatoes, you're taking off 2,000 pounds of organic material. But there were thousands of tons of organic material in that soil in Iowa and Illinois. But you know, it's like mining. And year after year, you keep taking that off. And where I'm from in California, the crop would run around 24 tons of potatoes to the acre. 24 tons. 48,000 pounds. Well, you'd keep doing that year after year after year, and pretty soon you consume a lot of that organic material, and the soil gets weaker and weaker and weaker. That's what happens to soil. It just gets weaker and weaker. And as the soil gets weaker, there's less nutrients in the soil for the plants that you're going to eat to eat. And then the insects come in. Now, here's a little strange thing about insects that maybe you'd never heard before. Insects are specialized little creatures that are designed to eat the sick, weak plants. So when you see a corn borer poking around through this ear of corn, he's designed by God to do that so that you will not eat that ear of corn, because the corn borer only eats nutritionally deficient and defective corn ears. Same thing with the cotton boll weevil and all these various and sundry insects. They, you know, boll weevils don't eat corn, and corn borers don't eat bolls of cotton. So every plant will have an insect that eats it. Out in California, we had a plant that invaded after World War II, was brought over here from Australia. It was called the Klamath weed, and the reason they called it Klamath weed is because it first showed up on the Klamath River around Klamath, California. And this weed didn't have any natural enemy, so it just took over the countryside and filled up the fields, and people looked at it and said, oh my God, we've been infested with this Klamath weed. Well, somebody got wise. You know, you go out and you spray it with DDT or with some pesticide, but you know, that comes to an end after a while. And so they said, well, we can't control this with chemicals. It costs too much. So they went to Australia and they found the Klamath weed beetle. Now, they didn't call them Klamath weeds and Klamath weed beetles down in Australia. They got a name for them down there, no doubt. But they brought this beetle that eats this Klamath weed back, and they stuck it out there. And boy, this Klamath weed beetle just took off. I mean, they just multiplied like crazy because there was plenty of food. And then as the years went by, the Klamath weed became less and less, and the Klamath weed beetles, it was thought, when I was a kid, they used to say, well, those Klamath weeds are going to go out and eat redwood trees now because they don't have anything else to eat. Once they've consumed all the Klamath weed, then we'll have a second pest, and they'll go out and eat our trees or something else. And the truth of the matter is, when the Klamath weed gets under control and there's not enough of it, the population of Klamath weed beetles deteriorates. You never get rid of all of them. And any time a little infestation of Klamath weed breaks out, there'll be beetles that'll come in there and eat it. And that's what you have with potatoes, and that's what you have with corn and cotton. Now, when the ground is fully charged up and it's got all of the nutrients that it needs, then you got strong, healthy plants, and these strong, healthy plants are what you're looking for, because when you eat an ear of corn, you want corn that has somewhere around 18% protein. You're not going to find any of that, but that's what you're looking for. Now, it would have 18% protein if the ground was strong. I've got some corn here that tested 16%. We never did get up to 18 yet, but we're working on it. But we did have some that tested 16. Most of it in this country tests around 8, 9, 10%. That's if it's good. Some of it tests as low as 5%, and if you feed that to pigs, they'll starve to death on it. And that's what's happening to Americans. Americans are eating this corn that tests 5% protein and should be testing 16, and it should have a full complement of minerals, and it doesn't. And then they have nutritive deficiencies, and then they come down with cancer and muscular dystrophy and multiple sclerosis, and then they can't figure out why, so they go to the doctor, and the doctor never tells them because he doesn't know. He's been to medical school. He doesn't understand the connection between nutrition and disease. And so he gives them drugs, and the drugs in some cases make them feel real good. And so then they give praises to the doctors, but they never go back to the farmers and say, gee, farmer, why don't you grow better food? Now, in the meantime, there are some farmers out here that picked up on this. They learned it from the veterinarians, because you see, when we have a sick cow, we don't have the time, effort, or energy, or the money to expend on a cow with a gallbladder problem. We can't afford cow gallbladder operations and cow liver and lung transplants. So when we get a sick cow and we ask the question, well, what's wrong with this cow? Well, she's nutritively deficient. And so the veterinarian comes out and he tests her and he says, well, there's not enough iron, copper, manganese, or something else here. Or there's not enough protein. I remember I was feeding some hay. One of my cows went down. She couldn't get up. She just got weak. Couldn't get up. And the vet came out and he said, let's test your hay. And sure enough, he tested the hay, and the hay was so weak in protein. He said, well, that's why she's down. That's why she's sick. That's why she's weak. She can't get enough nutrient out of that hay that you're feeding her to keep her alive. So I had to start feeding her some grain. You know, I had to give her grain. She was down on the ground. I fed her grain and alfalfa pellets for a week, and she got stronger and stronger. And I went down there and I picked her up with a hydraulic and got her on her feet and got her walking around a little bit. And yeah, she survived. She got up and she's fine today. I got to watch her, you know, make sure she's got plenty to eat, because she gives too much milk. She just milks herself to death. One of these hybrid cows, Jersey. Well, now, how can we use this knowledge and this information? How can we put the Bible and land Sabbaths and Jubilees and organic agriculture together with inorganic chemical pesticides and fertilizers and put the story together and come out with a solution, something that tells us what we can do to alleviate disease, pain, suffering, and anguish, and at the same time, save as much money as possible, give ourselves the best possible health. Now, for instance, I don't have any insurance at all. None. We don't have any health insurance. No member of my family does. And we're not looking for it. We don't feel bad because we don't have it. In fact, we're trying to avoid it, like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And the only people that buy health insurance are people that are sick or expect to get sick, and we're healthy and we expect to stay healthy and get healthier. Therefore, why would we want to buy insurance? Somebody says, well, you never know. You could get sick. No, that's the difference between you and me, partner. I know I'm not going to get sick. I eat well. And I've been doing this, you know, for 30 years, so I can tell you when I start to get a sore throat, I know that I've got a nutrient deficiency. I fast for 3 or 4 days. I start taking vitamin C. Sore throat, vitamin C. Sore throat, vitamin C. Gout, B vitamins. Gout, B vitamins. Muscle cramps, calcium. Muscle cramps, calcium. See, when you pick up on these symptoms, it doesn't take you very long to figure out, well, what is the nutrient deficiency that we're suffering from? And then we go concentrate on the foods that have a lot of those nutrients in them. You need vitamin C? Well, citrus is good, but then so are strawberries and bell peppers. And so when you're short of various and sundry minerals and vitamins, you know, you can buy it over the counter, but it's kind of expensive. If you got good soil in your garden, and it isn't difficult to make good soil. I mean, we can put organic material in the soil and get the earthworms to growing, and those earthworm castings, you know, they just create wonderful soil with all the vitamins and minerals and protein in your plants. And then when you eat this food, and this is what organic people are looking for. That's what they're looking for. And they're paying a premium price to get it. paying a premium. And there's about 4,000 little organic farms all over America with just little mom-and-pop family operations making $100,000, $200,000 a year. I was driving up the Central Valley of California here a few months back, and I was looking off to the right, and I saw this little Jap farmer out there, a Japanese guy and his wife and a couple of kids were out here with hoes, and they were hoeing away on a cabbage patch, probably about 5 acres of cabbage. You know how much that's worth? This guy's making about $200,000 a year in sales. Man and his wife and two kids. Cabbage patch. Hang on here, I gotta pay the rent. Listen to this. You're listening to The Law Hour. And The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, this genocidal global 2000 policy and New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. You know, Jesus of Nazareth held that same view. And here's what he said in Matthew 24, verse 22. He said that except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. Yeah, he said, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. You know, there's never been a time in human history when the extinction of mankind was a possibility until 1964. Then nuclear annihilation became a real possibility. But it's getting worse than that. Disease and nutritive failure and land failure is now a problem that ranks right up there with nuclear destruction. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in the scripture detailing this New World Order and the Global 2000 Genocide Plan. 64 of these life-threatening problems. It's called Bible prophecy. And the scripture teaches preparation for this, preparation for a thing called the Great Tribulation. It doesn't teach apathy and indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I get wise and wise up and start listening more to God and stop following after all these crazy scientists at Monsanto and philosophers, you know, like Bertrand Russell, and preachers, you know, who's this guy, Jerry Falwell, Billy Graham, and Oral Roberts, and these politicians, you know, like Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter and Hillary or that guy John in the Justice Department. I say it's time for us to prepare to live through and survive this global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Now, if you'd like to learn more about that, Subsistence and Survival is on CD. It's on my General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. And remember that my Subsistence and Survival School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, and click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or 417-273-4967. And that's what we're talking about, is subsistence and survival. That's what organics are all about. And the reason that I'm into organics is because if I eat chemical food, genetically modified organisms that are sprayed with pesticides and grown with chemical fertilizers, I can't get the nutrition that I need. And all disease is disease. Dis-ease. Take the word apart. It's dis-ease. It means I don't feel good. I'm ill at ease. Disabled. You know, you're able or able-bodied, and then you become disabled. Okay, you have ease, and then you become diseased. You feel good, and then you start feeling bad. Well, all disease is a symptom. So you have a symptom, and maybe you've got the palsy, and your hand shakes, or maybe, you know, maybe you've got pain, and you've got arthritis or rheumatism. And listen, if you've got arthritic pains, and you got rheumatism, or you've got the palsy and your hands are shaking, you have a nutritional deficiency or you're being poisoned. You know, if you give somebody arsenic, he'll get diseased. He'll get to feeling real bad. And if you starve a man, that is, you just withhold his vitamin C, he'll get scurvy. And you know, you can get pellagra. And you can get scurvy. And what you do to solve these problems is you give this guy vitamin C and the scurvy goes away. You give him vitamin B vitamins and his pellagra goes away. You see? So all diseases are nutritive in their origin. So when the turn of the century occurred, that is about 1900, 100 years ago, turn of the century, there was one person in 33 who would develop cancer in his lifetime. Today it's almost one in two. It will be in 2020, 16 years from now, it'll be one out of one. Every person in America is going to get cancer beginning in 2020. Now, something pretty dramatic has occurred. Well, at the very same time that we have been experimenting with all of these chemicals, pesticides, hybridized GMOs, hybridized seed, we see a tremendous rise in disease in America. Americans are the sickest people in the world. Americans are the sickest people in the world. And we have degenerative disease. Now, we're doing pretty good with infectious disease. You don't see too many Americans getting cholera or some disease, you know, that's spread by disease organisms, viruses and bacteria, you know, like TB. But boy, do we have a problem with things like muscular dystrophy and multiple sclerosis and cancer and heart disease and stroke, degenerative disease. And that's caused by a combination of the two, poisons in our food and food that does not contain enough nutrients to feed our bodies. That's all there is to it. People complain about headaches. You got a nutritional disease deficiency, or you got a poison. That's all. You got tunnel carpal syndrome. Now listen, let me show you something. I'm 65 years old, and I milk 3 cows every day, and I take 5 gallons of milk out of those 3 cows, and I milk by hand, and I've been milking by hand all of my life. I do not have tunnel carpal syndrome. I don't even have sore hands. So what we have are people today that are so weak from nutritional deficiencies and poisonings that when they sit at the typewriter and they type for any period of time, their wrists begin to hurt. They develop pains. These aren't phantom pains. These are real pains. You have real tunnel carpal syndrome caused by nutritional deficiency and poisons in your body. Okay. Now, if you'd prefer to continue on with that pain and collect workman's compensation and go to doctors and have them shoot you full of drugs, well, you're on the right track. Just keep right after that. Now, for the few of you that say to yourselves, well, gee, I'm not sure that shooting me full of drugs is going to do me any good over the long haul, maybe I'd like to cure that. You can do that. You can cure your tunnel carpal syndrome. We need to start feeding you a little better. Now, we're coming up to that. The land Sabbath was designed by God to maintain soil fertility to keep you healthy, which means that every 7 years, 16%, see, every 7 years, let's take 100, and divide that by 7, and it's 14.29, so you lose 14% of your productivity every 7 years. You have to invest that 14% into the soil. Now, you can do it by buying, things like chemical fertilizers and sprays. You see, you can plant and you can use this land until you wear out, until you use up the organic material and you're practicing chemical farming. If you want to, you can do that. And anytime you want to change, you can change that too, and you can put the organic material back into the soil. You can bring in horse manure, and you can bring in weeds and anything. Just surface incorporate it. I teach a class on that here, how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less, and I use Plowman's Folly by Lee Faulkner to show you how to rebuild soil. I can rebuild soil. I can take concrete, just a cement slab, and I can put organic material on top of that cement slab, and you give me 7 years, I'll surface incorporate organic material on a cement slab, and I will have 100% top producing soil in 7 years. I can take any kind of soil, and so can you. Anybody can do this. It's no big secret. It's been in the Bible for 4,100 years that I know of. You can do it. Farmers don't want to do it. Bankers don't want to do it. The Department of Agriculture doesn't want to do it. But if you're one of those iconoclasts that says, well, gee, how could I build my soil? I don't care where you live. We can rebuild your soil. Take 7 years to do that. In some cases, it'll take less. Now, you can maintain that soil fertility by letting that land rest once every 7 years. So here's what happened. Soil builds up, that is topsoil, that rich layer of topsoil, of which there's only about 6 or 7 inches on the soil worldwide. Out in Iowa, the buffalo would walk across, eat the grass. It would go through the animal, come out the other end as manure, and every 90 years it builds up 1 inch of topsoil. 1 inch. If they don't eat the grass, it doesn't make any difference. It just takes a little longer for the grass to break down. The manure will break down in 24 months. The grass takes about 36 to 48. So the grass grows up, it dies down, and it rots, and it goes into the soil, which becomes the food for the new grass plants that are growing up. The buffalo eats the new grass plants that's growing up, goes through the animal, comes out the other end, goes back in. This is a cycle. Now, the grass needs about 75 to 90% organic material to grow, and this organic material acts like a sponge, and when it rains, it soaks up 100% of the water, and then stores the water for the roots of the plants, and that's why you never have drought when you have strong organic soil, and that's why you have drought when you overfarm the land. There's no drought out in the forest. The drought is in the fields, not in the fence rows in the forest. So if we would farm the way God described it and told us and followed the 15 agricultural laws, we wouldn't have any problems. And that's what organic is all about. Organic is where we're actually trying to go back to practicing what the Bible taught us, but we don't want to call it that. We want to call it crop rotation, or we want to call it organic farming. We'll call it anything. We're forced as a matter of survival to practice organic agriculture, because if we don't, we're going to destroy the soil and starve to death anyway. I mean, that's just where reality's at. But for some of us, we woke up and we said, you know, this chemical farming, I used to be a chemical farmer. I used to buy truckloads of these chemicals and put it on the ground. Wasted my money, couldn't make the grass grow. And one day I woke up and said, now how do we clean these chemicals out of the soil and how do we make the grass grow? And once I learned how to do that, boy, am I a farmer now. I've got ground here that was so poor 10, 15 years ago that it was bare dirt, and today I've got sod on it. Sod. It won't hide a horse with a rider on him yet, but you give me 90 years, and I'll have soil that'll be so strong that the grass will hide a man sitting on a horse. I've only been at it 20. And give me 70 more. Watch me. I know what the secret is, and I want to share it with you. All right, so that's the story of the organic farming that comes from Leviticus chapter 23, land Sabbaths and Jubilees. You do this 16 times per 100 years, once every 7 years, and then on the 50th year you have a double land Sabbath. It's a land Sabbath on the 49th, a Jubilee on the 50th. You do that on the 99th and the 100th year, and you just take that 7 divided into 49, you get 7 and 7 is 14, plus 1 and 1 is 16. That's 16 land Sabbaths. Now that means in 100 years, you're going to lose 16% of the productivity of your land. Now, you go ahead and farm that land. They call it virgin soil. You know, when you first come in here and you take it for the first time and you farm on it, they call that virgin land. Well, it takes about 100 years to wear it out. And then you have to start putting chemicals on it to make it grow. And then when the chemicals make the plants grow, the plants are nutritively deficient, and so the insects eat the plants. So now you got to have chemicals to kill the insects. Up in Wenatchee, Washington, back in the 30s, they used to have a lot of land up there that they grew apples on that today is nothing but a moonscape because the arsenic in the pesticide. See, they would grow the apples until they wore the land out. Then they would spray the apples with arsenic pesticide until the arsenic destroyed all the microorganisms in the soil and killed the trees. Now the trees are dead. It won't grow any apples at all. It's a moonscape, and the land has been totally destroyed. And that's what mankind did to the Sahara and the Gobi Deserts. And desertification has set in some places in Iowa. Iowa. You can see the soil blowing. During the Great Depression, during the Dust Bowl era, we saw soil blowing all over the Midwest from drought. You tear up, destroy the organic material, open the soil up to the elements, and let it blow away. We humans are terrific when it comes to destroying the land and turning it into a desert like the Sahara, the Gobi. We're great. But we don't know jack squat about rebuilding the Gobi Desert and the Sahara. We'll have to wait until Jesus returns. And then when he takes over in the millennial rule, he'll show us, let's go back to the Sahara Desert and let's turn this Sahara into a cropland. Let's turn it into a Great Plains again. We'll do it. In fact, we've begun right now. Along the Mediterranean coast of North Africa, we're planting trees. They've got a 30-mile band of trees that go from Morocco to Egypt. And the rainfall is increasing. They're on the right track. We know how to do it. It's a shame that we went into the Sahara and destroyed it to start with. But we're on the right track. We can rebuild it. Unfortunately, we are destroying 100 square miles. We are turning 100 square miles a year of the desert, that is Africa. We're turning it into desert, 100 square miles a year. We are destroying 4,000 square miles of rainforest a year. We're doing a marvelous job of destroying the rainforest of South America at 4,000 miles a year, square miles a year. Here's what we're doing. In 1957, the rainfall in South America was 120 inches in the Amazon jungle, 120 inches a year. Today it's 90. It's down 30 inches. Every time we cut off one square mile of rainforest, we get less trees. You see, the rain that comes down upon the rainforest is given off by percolation from the trees. The tree sucks it up through the roots, percolates it off in the leaves. It goes off into the atmosphere, condenses into rain, and rains back down on the ground. For instance, if you got a mature oak tree, like I'm looking at one right outside my studio window here, it's a great big oak, probably 2 foot on the stump, probably 100 years old, maybe a little more. It gives off 1,800 gallons of moisture, 1,800 gallons of water into the atmosphere every year. 1,800 gallons a year. Now, put 9 of those trees in an acre. 9 times 18. 16,200 gallons of water per acre. Now, I've got 200 acres on my farm. So if we take 16,000 times 200, that'll give us, 3,200,000 gallons of rain, or gallons of rain fall every year off of my 200 acres. Now my neighbor Dale Smith over here, now he bulldozed all of his off. He's got all grass over there to feed his cows. When he bulldozed it all off, his springs went dry. The organic material in the soil was so weak to start with that it won't support grass. He thought he was going to move from 40 cows up to 100 cows, and now he has no cows because he has no water. He destroyed his land. Now, I'm on the same weak soil, and I'm building my soil. I don't have 200 acres of grass, but I do have about 20 acres of grass. And my 20 acres of grass will support my 20 cows. I buy the hay, and I leave the trees so that I have 3,200,000 gallons of rain, which also falls over here at my neighbor Dale. Falls on his ground, too. But unfortunately, Dale cut off all of his trees, and he doesn't have any organic material on top of the soil to hold the rain so it all washes off, and it leaches out the organic material that's there and washes it down the creeks, down the rivers, and into Bull Shoals Lake. My land, on the other hand, has strong sod, and when it rains, it holds it right there on the soil. When it rains in the forest is covered with leaves and litter, and it holds it right there, and I have no leaching of my organic material. I don't have much to start with, but the little I've got, I'm hanging on to. And every year, I keep increasing the organic material, and the more organic material I have in my soil, The more water my soil will hold, the more water my soil will hold, the heavier and richer the organic material, the more minerals and vitamins, and the healthier the plants that grow in it, and the fewer insects we have. Now, there are birds out here. I have birds by the thousands. I feed them here year-round. I cultivate birds because birds eat bugs. They eat insects. So you know these insects that might be down here eating, you know, my plants. Well, you got a natural balance out here. This is called the ecosystem. Now, my neighbor Dale over here, he used to put a lot of chemicals on his ground, and it killed the organic material in the soil. You know those 186,000 little critters? Yeah, see, when you're putting these chemicals on the soil, it kills the ants, the nematodes, it kills the termites, it just kills all of these critters. And when it kills the critters aren't there converting the inorganic material into organic material, which is the food that the plant next year is going to have. So you got to make the plant food this year with those 186,000 critters. I've got all my critters working in my cubic foot of soil. He does. He is turning his farm into a desert, and I'm turning my farm into a Garden of Eden. Now, it's just a matter of learning how to use the soil. It's no big mystery. But if you've been to college, you're working at a big disadvantage coming right out of the chute. See, I went to ag school, and what I learned in ag school was how to turn the Garden of Eden into the Sahara Desert. And we learned that through chemical and industrial agriculture. Chemical and industrial agriculture is what they teach you in ag school. Now, if you want to learn how to do agriculture instead of agribusiness, then we go back to the Bible and we take a look at these 15 agricultural laws, and then we take a look at organic farming as it's being done around the world, not just in the United States, but organic farming. There's a lot of good information out there, and we'll show you exactly how to do that. And I teach two classes, subsistence and survival, and how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less. And we'll teach you how to maintain that soil, teach you how to build soil, too. If you got bad soil, teach you how to build it. Now, with this out of the way, let's talk about over the past decades. There's been an unprecedented push toward an environmentally responsible and healthy approach to consumption. Far from being a hobby horse for a few cranky individuals and organizations, this movement has gathered converts from all walks of life and from all areas of science and medicine. And what's more, it sparked the imagination of consumers worldwide. The result has been the biggest revolution in farming, manufacturing, and consumption since the Second World War. And that movement is called organic. Now, for most of us, the word organic means food. Organic food production has finally hit the mainstream with the 21st century emphasis on health and well-being. It could not have come at a better time. As long ago as the 1960s, experts were expressing concern about what was going into and onto our food during its production. In 1962, for example, Rachel Carson's groundbreaking book Silent Spring warned that the use of pesticides would endanger human health and wildlife. In 1968, Science magazine published an article linking the decline of bird populations with reproductive failure due to pesticide accumulations. In 1975, the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality stated that dairy and meat products accounted for over 95% of the population's intake of the pesticide DDT. That's why I don't eat dairy and meat products produced inorganically that's what you buy out of your supermarket. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. In 1989, the World Health Organization estimated that 1 million pesticide poisonings occurred in the world every year, resulting in 20,000 deaths. Then we entered the 1990s with BSE, Salmonella, BST, gender bender chemicals, irradiation, genetic engineering, and more. And as consumers responded with demands for change, the answer presented itself, and it's simply going organic. It means taking responsibility. You see, the organic movement involves much more than simply avoiding the use of chemicals. Its aims are manifold. They offer an answer to many of the woes of 21st century life. Pollution, farming crises, declining wildlife species, superbugs and pests, soil erosion, waste buildup, chronic health problems, and even overfishing. The organic movement is responsible, which means that it's driven not by profit margins or quick fix solutions, but by a genuine regard for the natural world. The original aim of organic farming was to create a system that depends upon the development of biological cycles, using crop rotation, and making the most of natural fertilizers. Organic farmers near or rear animals naturally and with great concern for their welfare. These farmers help to conserve the wildlife and habitats around their farms. Organic farming means using nature's own tools to do something natural, grow and harvest food that is safe for everyone and everything around it. These aims are entirely consistent with the growing sense of responsibility that most consumers feel. And for that reason, the organic movement has not only prospered, but has grown on an international level in a way that nobody could have predicted. Almost every country in the Western world now has an organic authority with certification programs cropping up almost as quickly as new organic products. Leading environmentalists around the world have set targets and prepared initiatives to encourage the growth of the movement. Organic is not a trend, it's a reality. However, looking beyond questions of food and toward our lifestyle is very important, and that's what we're all about in this series of programs. Now, organic is a philosophy of life. I'm going to take that up in the next segment or the next hour. It'll be tomorrow night. But I want to introduce you to a book called Organic Living. It's printed by or written by Karen Sullivan. In 10 Simple Lessons. Organic Living in 10 Simple Lessons. Karen Sullivan. Well, let's see. The book is published by Barron's. I think we picked this up at Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble. Now, let's see what else we got in here. Well, there's a lot of numbers in here. God, it's printed in China by the Hong Kong Graphics and Printing Limited. Now, you'd think we'd print this in the United States of America. I always encourage people to buy American and use American, but let's try it here. The first edition for the United States and its territories, published exclusively by Barron's Educational Series Incorporated 2001 as a copyright date. Copyrighted 2001 by Ivy Press Limited. It's called the Ivy Press Limited. And the name of the book, Organic Living in 10 Simple Lessons, Karen Sullivan. We'll take a look here at what is organic, why go organic food, buying organic, growing organic, cooking organic for children, organic in the home, organic the wider picture. And nobody's perfect, and I'll give you a sampling of how you can participate in organic. It's good for your health, it's good for your environment, and it's good for your pocketbook. 12% of Americans buy organic. 12% of 290 million people, let's just take 290 times 12. That's 34 million people, that's about 35 million people, buy organic. That's a big market. We'll take that up next time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just go to the law school website, georgegordon.org. All right, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.